we are considering in some detail. We began this series two Lord's Day evenings ago by reviewing the many changes that we have made in our worship over the years, some of the rationale for those changes, and explaining why, at this particular historical moment, we and many other Christians are thinking again about our practice of the Lord's Supper. We spoke of how the change from an infrequent to an every Sunday celebration of communion has inevitably led to new questions being asked about the best way to observe the supper. And questions, natural questions, such as why do we do it as we do it when other Christians do the Lord's Supper in a different way. Obviously, we all want the maximum effect of the supper in our souls, and we know that form, though not the most important matter, of course, the heart and faith alive and at work in the heart are certainly much more important. They come first. Nevertheless, form can have a significant effect on how the supper is perceived and experienced by worshipers, which is why the Bible has so much to say about form in worship. Among the changes that are being made widely in conservative, Bible-believing, and Reformed and Presbyterian churches like ours are a return to wine after several generations of using grape juice for the cup in the Lord's Supper, and also moving away from the long-standing practice of pew communion or taking the elements while seated in pews. These and other matters are our subjects in this evening series on the practice of the Lord's Supper, or what is called in the literature, the shape of the Lord's Supper. We pointed out that our practice of the Lord's Supper is traditional. In large part, it must be traditional because we are not given anywhere in the Bible an explicit account of a Lord's Supper service in apostolic Christianity. But being traditional, we know that there are influences in our practice that come out of the historical periods and the historical movements that shaped that tradition. And therefore, it is important from time to time to review that practice, that tradition, to be sure that we're using the form that is best suited to convey to our souls the true meaning and experience of the supper as we worship together. It has, for example, as we said, been traditional for Reformed and Presbyterian Christians in America not to kneel for prayer in public worship, an explicitly biblical custom that was lost because of a long-forgotten controversy in England and Scotland centuries ago. Traditions can sometimes perpetuate mistakes, and given the fact that our way of doing the Lord's Supper is not the only way of doing it, more Christians receive the Lord's Supper in a different way than receive it in our way, but also that it wasn't even the practice of the Lord's Supper in the first generation or two of the Reformation, to which we look back as the foundation of our history. There's surely reason for us to revisit our traditional practice to see if it really is the best. Last Lord's Day evening, we began our consideration of the question of using wine in communion. Now, some of you may be thinking to yourself, why in the world why are we taking so much time to discuss a question as small and perhaps in your mind as simple as this? Well, there are several reasons. One, because we have for a long time not used wine. And for a long time we didn't use wine because a large number of Christian people in our tradition felt that it was decidedly wrong to use wine. And that opinion is abroad in the church still today, and we must respect it and we must deal with it. But also because we're not interested simply in throwing out an explanation that will do for the moment and making a change in our practice. We want to enter in to the practice. We want to know how wine figures in the practice of the Lord's Supper in the Bible. Why wine? It wasn't the only drink in the ancient world. It could have been milk. It could have been water. Why wine? These are questions that serious Christians shouldn't want to know the answer to, so that when they come to the use of wine in the Lord's Supper, it's not simply a freedom that now they have, which once they did not, but it is a more complete and a more biblically holistic experience of the Lord's Supper that we received and we are after. So in order to pay proper attention to the arguments advanced against the use of wine, I'm setting out the case against Christians drinking wine, and by extension its use in the sacrament, as that case was made by Pastor John MacArthur in a series of sermons he preached a few years ago at his Grace Community Church in Southern California. We have a high regard for Pastor MacArthur, and having listened to his tapes, I think he has made the case against the use of wine in Christian living and in the Supper of our Lord, as it is ordinarily made and about as well as it can be made. Last Lord's Day evening, we considered his first argument, namely that the wine of biblical times was not really what we call wine today. It was a much less alcoholic drink than wine is today, really more like our grape juice, in fact, and that therefore one cannot make out from the Bible and the Bible's use of the word wine a case for drinking wine today, because the two drinks are really very dissimilar and are dissimilar at exactly that point that distinguishes wine as an alcoholic drink. The word in the Bible means something very different than what the word wine means today. We considered that claim and found it virtually completely without any support in any scholarship. Biblical scholarship, historical secular scholarship, or the scholarship of wine and viticulture itself. What is more, we found that the biblical depiction of wine and wine making did not really agree with the picture that Pastor MacArthur was attempting to paint. Rather, all the evidence suggested that wine in the ancient world was very largely what wine is today. Wine is created as a result of a chemical process that results from the combination of yeast and sugars that are found in the grape and the grape skins themselves, and unless something is brought in to check it, to check that process, wine will result from the fermentation of juice pressed from the grapes by a fixed law. Interestingly, I have in my file a similar argument to that made by Pastor MacArthur, this time by a man by the name of Stephen Reynolds. Dr. Reynolds has a PhD from Princeton University, was a member of the translation team of the New International Version of the Bible. He's a scholar of ancient Greek of some qualification, but his argument reduces to the same logic that is so persuasive to Pastor MacArthur and has been so persuasive to so many over the past several generations in our churches. He cannot believe that God would approve of a substance the abuse of which causes great harm. And from this vantage point, he views the various texts of the Bible in which wine is mentioned and concludes that where in a biblical text wine is mentioned approvingly, the word means grape juice. And where its power to inebriate is at all in view, it means an alcoholic beverage that the Bible forbids Christians to drink. He admits, of course, which Pastor MacArthur never really did in his sermon, Dr. Reynolds admits that the words used are the same in both instances, and it's the context alone that determines whether we are to read the word as grape juice or wine. If the Bible is speaking approvingly, it means grape juice. If it is speaking disapprovingly, it means wine. Now, Dr. Reynolds is a scholar, so he is forced to admit something that, again, Pastor MacArthur didn't mention in his sermon, namely that hardly anyone agrees with him. No dictionary of ancient Greek, no major commentator on the biblical passages themselves, neither evangelical nor liberal, no historian of ancient Near Eastern culture, and what is more, no English translation of the Bible, not one, from John Wycliffe to the New International Version. They all missed this distinction he purports to find in the biblical use of these terms rendered wine and strong drink by everyone else. These are good men, and they are certain in their hearts that the Lord would never recommend an alcoholic beverage, never permit, and certainly never celebrate its use. For that reason, they are sure there must be a way to read the Bible that does not lead to that result. But in doing so, I don't believe they have been faithful to the plain speaking of the Bible, to the ordinary meaning of words, or to the nature of biblical ethics, for that matter, as we shall see in due course. We concluded then last week by saying that the fact that wine was used in the Last Supper and the Lord's Supper according to the testimony of Scripture and of early Christianity, is a fact with which Christians must reckon when they consider the question of how the Lord's Supper ought to be observed by Christians today. Now we proceed. Pastor MacArthur's second point is that wine is not necessary. If wine is not explicitly forbidden in the Bible, it is a choice for Christians today, but it is not a necessary choice. His first point was that the wine of the ancient world was not what we know as wine. His second point is that it is not necessary for Christians to drink today's wine, and if not necessary, then why should they do it? He admits that in biblical times it may have been necessary. It was necessary in some cases because there wasn't anything else to drink. It was necessary in other cases because of the expectations of society. That is why, says Pastor MacArthur, the Bible does not give a blanket condemnation of wine, because it might in some circumstances be necessary for Christians to drink it. Now, there are any number of responses that could be made to this argument against the drinking of wine, namely that it isn't necessary. I'll make just these. First, perhaps it occurred immediately to you that Pastor MacArthur cannot have his cake and eat it too. If wine in the Bible is really grape juice, either a completely non-intoxicating fruit drink, or a drink with such a low alcoholic content that a state of drunkenness was very difficult to achieve, and that's what Pastor MacArthur says the word wine refers to in the Bible, then what does necessity have to do with it, and why would the Bible ever, under any circumstances, for any reason, give a blanket condemnation of the drinking of wine? Surely grape juice may be drunk by anybody at any time for any reason. And if that's what wine was, then it was no more necessary in biblical times than it is today. Anyone could have drunk it at any time. Second, time and again, through Pastor MacArthur's presentation, I noted that he would say such things as, the Bible doesn't give a blanket condemnation of wine. But that is hardly a fair representation of what the Bible actually says about wine. The fact is, as pitiless as the Bible is in its condemnation of drunkenness, it has many wonderful things to say about wine. It celebrates wine time and time again. It uses it as an image of the day of salvation, as an image of the messianic kingdom of salvation itself. It is a gift that men ought to give to God Himself when they come with their sacrifices. Wine makes glad the heart of a man. It is one of God's favors that He bestows upon His people, and so on. It completely misstates the situation to imply that the Bible has a negative view of wine at all, in the least. It has a decidedly negative view of drunkenness, we shall see, have seen, but a decidedly positive view of wine. Wine is never drunk as a necessity in the Bible. Never once is it described as the lesser of two evils. Never once does anybody in the Bible describe it in the way in which Pastor MacArthur does. Third, I don't know, and Mr. MacArthur doesn't say, what the necessity might be that justified wine drinking in the ancient world. They had other things to drink, just as we do, water and milk among them, and those drinks were staples. So far as I can tell, no one drank wine in the ancient world because he or she had to, unless I suppose they were lost in the desert and had nothing else in their canteen. Wine was complicated to make. It cost more than milk or water. Perhaps he means that if you were a guest at some banquet and wine were set before you, you would not feel free to decline it for fear of offending your host. But there would be no reason to decline it for fear of offending your host if the wine was only grape juice anyway. On Pastor MacArthur's own account, you couldn't have got drunk on the wine that was offered you unless you not only drank your own wine, but that which had been served to everyone else at the table as well. Let me simply respond to Pastor MacArthur's argument that wine is not necessary by saying that the Bible never raises the issue of the necessity in respect to wine, or to many other things as well, like wine in their ethical interest for Christians. The Bible considers wine one of God's good gifts. It celebrates its use in many different ways. Pastor MacArthur's third argument is that wine is not the best choice. Given that the Bible does not explicitly forbid the drinking of wine, it is a choice. But then Christians have to ask themselves, is it the best choice? Now, we begin our response in the same way we did before. If wine is only grape juice, then why is it not the best choice? Why would anyone think it were not the best choice? This is the fatal self-contradiction in the argument that is being made against the drinking of wine. But listen carefully to the argument as Pastor MacArthur makes it, and with some passion. John the Baptist, whom Jesus himself declared to be the greatest man born of woman, didn't drink wine, ever. He was, in modern parlance, a teetotaler. It was for him, apparently, a part of the Nazarite vow that God made for him before his birth and told his parents would be the rule of John's life. But as we read in Numbers chapter 6, verse 1, anyone could step up to that higher standard, take a Nazarite vow, forsake the drinking of wine. Surely we all want to live lives for Christ at the highest standard possible. And that standard in the Bible was marked by the absence of wine. What is more, the priests, when they served in the sanctuary, were not permitted to drink wine, according to the law of Moses. And in Proverbs 31, 4 through 6, we read, "It is not for kings, O Lemuel, not for kings to drink wine, nor for rulers to crave beer, lest they drink and forget what the law decrees and deprive the oppressed of their rights. Give beer to those who are perishing, wine to those who are in anguish. Let them drink and forget their poverty and remember their misery no more." And then there are the Rechabites, whom we mentioned this morning from Jeremiah chapter 35. They were a faithful people to whom Jeremiah pointed the Israelites as an example of everything that the Israelites weren't in his generation. Faithful to God. Faithful to the ancient way. And their faithfulness was demonstrated by the fact that they did not drink wine even when it was offered to them, because their forefather Jonadab had commanded them not to do so. And they remained faithful through the generations, through the commandment of their forefather, even when Israel was departing from the commandments of God himself. Pastor MacArthur's point, as you see, is that while wine drinking is not condemned per se in these different ways, a refusal to drink wine is a feature of a higher and holier life. It was forbidden to kings and priests, but we're all to be kings and priests after a fashion. Now, there is something to reckon with here, of course. I hope we all wish for the holiest and highest life of which we are capable, a life of unqualified devotion to the Lord, untrammeled, unweakened by any vice, a life of ready forsaking of the world and the flesh, if only we might serve the Lord more faithfully. But surely there is no argument here against the drinking of wine. The Nazarite vow was a vow of temporary consecration. Only in certain highly unique cases, John the Baptist and Samson in particular, was it the rule of someone's entire life. It was a vow of self-denial. Not only was no wine drunk, the man who made that vow was not to drink grape juice or even eat a grape. That rule was a way of demonstrating the completeness of one's consecration to God. Likewise, they could not cut their hair, nor could they even mourn loved ones who happened to die during the time of their vow. Think also of John the Baptist's unusual clothing and his strange diet. He had separated himself from the normal life of mankind for the sake of symbolizing his consecration to God, all for the purpose of this special calling that was his as the forerunner of the Messiah. But of course, it was only symbolically an entire devotement of one's life to God. The vow had a time limit. There were stipulations in the regulations of the Nazarite vow concerning how the vow was to be ended with sacrifices and so on. And what is perfectly clear is that in the Nazarite vow, wine is refused precisely because it is one of those things that enriches life. It is much the same way as fasting is a demonstration of consecration to God, because food is good and our bodies crave it so. And so doing without it is a sacrifice. It's a loss. A loss you're willing to make to emblemize your consecration of yourself to God. It was a sacrifice not to be able to mourn one's loved ones when they died, and it was a sacrifice not to drink wine. The Nazarite vow is a demonstration of the very point that Pastor MacArthur is unwilling to make, namely that wine is good and was a normal part of a believer's life in biblical times. The priests were forbidden to drink wine while ministering in the sanctuary, Leviticus 10, verse 9, again as a symbol of their complete consecration to God. Commentators disagree, however, as to the precise reason, and the Bible never exactly spells it out. Some suggest that Israel's priests were forbidden to use alcohol during the service in the sanctuary because pagan priests around them used inebriation as a method of consulting with the gods. Others think it was simply as a precaution against any loss of the soundest mind while responsible for such sacred things. The idea in Proverbs 31 is again similar. A king should not be under the influence when making judgments that affect people's lives. The consequences of bad decisions are too great. That is all that is meant, however. In fact, it's worth pointing out that in Proverbs 31:6, which we read, which speaks of giving wine to the perishing and those who are in anguish, Mr. MacArthur's entire case is lost. Obviously, wine had an effect, and not only when drunk in immense quantities, as Pastor MacArthur claimed. It could be used to dampen emotional pain. And in the case of the Rechabites, their not drinking wine had nothing to do with any sin in wine drinking, with any idea that drinking wine was not the practice of the most godly and the most committed of people. Jeremiah drank wine. It had only to do, as Jeremiah 35 makes clear, with the Rechabites' solemn vow to remain nomads, not to settle down, not to plant vineyards, not to press grapes, not to live in houses. If you want to be sure you're never going to be tempted to plant a vineyard, then don't become a drinker of wine. And Jonadab wanted his people, his descendants, to be nomads. The not drinking of wine was part of this nomadic lifestyle, part of their commitment to it. Now, all of this argument, however well-intentioned by Pastor MacArthur, it seems to me completely misses the point. It isn't wine drinking that is at stake here or is at issue in these various places. It isn't drinking something that has the capacity to inebriate. It isn't a negative judgment made on drinking alcoholic beverages. It is, in every case, a summons to forbear wine and other perfectly good and proper things, by the way, for a time, either as a sacrifice made to God or for the purpose of maintaining the clearest head at the most crucial moment. What Christian person who favors the drinking of wine would disagree with either the notion of forsaking it temporarily for spiritual reasons or for not drinking it on purpose at certain moments? I am, as it happens, in the fortunate position of making the biblical case while being a person who doesn't much like wine. I have no vested interest in this decision personally. I am seeking nothing for myself. It would be no sacrifice for me to drink no wine for a period of time because I never drink wine. I don't like the taste. At Lent, for some years now, I have forsaken the drinking of iced tea, and that was a real sacrifice, a much greater sacrifice than the Nazarite vow, if you ask me. But it was a sacrifice precisely because it was something so good, something that I enjoy so much. And that is the place that wine occupied in biblical culture. The fact is, abstention from wine is unusual in the Bible. It was forbidden to be used in the way it was used in pagan religion, of course, and that may explain why Daniel did not want to drink the king's wine, Daniel 1:8. People abstained from wine for the sake of mourning, which indicates, again, the very positive view of wine that people had. Wine goes with happiness. It doesn't go with mourning. And then there were these other cases of abstaining, as we have seen. The Nazarites, for the duration of their vow, the priests, when they were ministering in the sanctuary, and the Rechabites as a way of preserving their nomadic way of life. But all of that is somewhat beside the point. What astonished me about this third argument Pastor MacArthur offered against Christians drinking wine was that he made a great point of saying that John the Baptist was the greatest man born of woman, and he was a teetotaler. And don't you want to aspire as a Christian to the highest possible standard? Surely you do. I was, of course, expecting him to, but he never then once raised the obvious and tremendous problem that Jesus Christ, one greater than John, by John's own testimony, drank wine. Our Savior drank wine. He drank it often enough and enjoyed it to a degree sufficient that he opened himself to the charge of being a drunk, as he enjoyed food enough to be charged with being a glutton by his enemies. It is even made a point of comparison by him between himself and John the Baptist. For John came neither eating nor drinking, and they say he has a demon. The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say here is a glutton and a drunkard. It's obviously talking about drinking wine, because drunkard. Jesus drank wine obviously and openly enough and in quantities sufficient so as to allow his enemies to accuse him of overindulging, which of course he never did. How can we possibly make the mark of a more devout and godly life than not drinking of wine when Jesus Christ himself, the perfect man, drank wine? John's special calling was marked by his Nazarite separation and asceticism, in that he is not a particular example for us, except to the extent that we fast. But Jesus is an example for us in every way and all the time, both when he fasts and when he eats and drinks. Seneca, the Stoic philosopher of first century Rome, once wrote this about some men he admired. Men say that Solon and Archelaus were given to wine, and Cato himself has been taxed by his enemies with drunkenness. But he who says that about Cato shall, in saying that, rather prove that drunkenness is a virtue than that Cato himself indulged indecently. We might say the same thing about the Lord Christ. Those who accused him of drunkenness rather prove that drunkenness is a virtue than that Jesus Christ drank too much. My point is that Christ drank wine, and for the Christian, that is the end of the story. So far as any possible moral claim that teetotaling is a higher form of godliness is concerned, it has always been, in my judgment, the greatest problem for the argument against drinking wine, as it has been made for generations now in American evangelicalism, that it has always amounted to an attempt, however unintentional, however unmeant, to improve on the ethics of Jesus Christ. And that is something no Christian should ever do, or presume to do, or appear to do. And the fact that Pastor MacArthur urges us to imitate John the Baptist and then says nothing in his sermon of the fact that Jesus' own behavior and conduct was not an imitation of John the Baptist in this point seems to me the ruination of his case, that not drinking wine is a better choice for Christians. So we have now taken up three of Pastor MacArthur's eight arguments against wine drinking by Christians, and by extension the use of wine in the Lord's Supper. The other five will go more quickly. I think we can cover them all next Lord's Day evening. And then we will look at the biblical data as a whole and form our view of wine and its place in the Lord's Supper. Remember, we're trying to determine the significance which we ought to attach and then which we ought to be able to appreciate of the unmistakable fact that wine was used for the first Lord's Supper and then ever thereafter, until very recently in Christian history. Amen.